happen before, Hazel pointed out to the sea. The only person left was a young boy dragging a sack behind him, picking through the detritus of the beachgoers. I hoped he wouldn't get struck by lightning, but he didn't seem concerned, and the storm did seem to be settling down. A steady rain drummed on the boardwalk, and the hollow sound of raindrops on the awning provided a watery symphony in stereo. The heat had dissipated, and a cool, briny breeze lifted off the water. Arthur pulled me under his arm, and I snuggled into his embrace. "So, are you nervous about your play, Hazel?" Arthur asked. His effort to make nice was pretty obvious, but I was glad he was trying. "I'm as fine as I can be," Hazel said. "I don't think there's anything that can calm my nerves at this point. We're all in."
"Hey, I'm jittery, and I'm not even a part of it."
Charlie laughed, watching Hazel for a response. When she smiled, he looked away, pleased. Something was going on between these two.
"I hear this guy's been your secret weapon," said Arthur, nodding to Charlie. "Maxine mentioned that he'd offered up some good advice."
"Maxine!" Hazel poked me in the ribs with her elbow. "I can't believe you!"
"What? I was just repeating what you'd told me." "Really? You think I helped?"
Now Charlie was practically incandescent. On one hand, I was relieved that Hazel had him wrapped around her finger so tightly. That was where we wanted him. On the other, was it a good idea to be that close to your minder? The rain was beginning to ease. I stuck my hand out and captured a couple of drops on my open palm.
"I've enjoyed watching the show come to life."
Charlie turned to Arthur.
"And Miss Meade is terrific. You'll love what she does on stage. There's this moment in the second act."
"No!" Hazel covered his mouth with her hand, then quickly withdrew it. "Have I taught you nothing?"
"Sorry."
He put his fingers on his lips, where her hand had just been.
"What? What's going on?" asked Arthur, perplexed.
"If he says something," explained Hazel, "it means that next time Maxine does the scene, she'll be thinking about recreating that exact moment, not discovering it fresh. That's why it's never a good idea to read reviews, good or bad. The words get stuck in your head, and then you're doomed." I pretended to pout.
"But I want to hear it. You know how I feel about compliments."
"Not a word," warned Hazel.
"Not a word, Maestra." Charlie nodded. "I promise."
Chapter 14. Hazel. July 1950. While Arthur and Maxine roared around on the cyclone, Charlie again apologized for his father's behavior. "You should be angry at him, too," answered Hazel. "I can't believe he left you behind." "He doesn't like to be crossed. Once when I was 8 years old, I complained about something, and he made me walk 4 miles home from my grandmother's house." Always the city kid, Hazel did the calculation. 4 miles was 80 New York City blocks. Almost unimaginable. "That's horrible. He's not exactly the warm and fuzzy type." "My mother isn't either, although she'd never send me on a forced march like that." He stared out at the sea, avoiding her gaze. "You made up an excuse about the roller coaster for me, didn't you? Because you knew I couldn't ride it?" "I just figured it'd be easier that way. You shouldn't be embarrassed." "Thanks. It's just around a tough guy like Arthur." He didn't finish the sentence. "How long have he and Maxine been together?" "A long time. Years, apparently. The more I get to know him, the more I can understand why Maxine is drawn to him, even though there are aspects of him that I don't like. He's complicated, but then so is Maxine, who, no doubt, can be difficult at times." He lifted a brow. "You don't say." She couldn't help but laugh. "I know, she's a diva, but she's more insecure than she lets on." "She's not like you, then." "Me? I'm very insecure." "You don't show it." "I can't afford to. Not when people like your father call me Little Missy. I have to stay on my guard." You are as far from a little missy as they come, trust me. I'm not sure how to take that. It's a compliment. His gaze was sweet, warm. She was used to seeing him in a suit, and his casual outfit, khakis and a short-sleeved linen shirt, made him seem far more approachable. Have you read the play, All My Sons? I saw it on Broadway. You should read it. There's nothing like reading a play to understand how the theme gets woven through. I have a copy. I'll bring it to rehearsal. It's about a son realizing the truth about his father. I already know the truth about my father. Trust me. Then why don't you step out from under his shadow? Make your own way in the world. For a moment, they stared at each other, as if trying to figure the other one out. He was about to answer when Maxine skipped over, trailed by Arthur, beaming with exhilaration from the ride. Rain poured down hard the whole drive back from Coney Island, and Hazel was happy to not have to make conversation above the din. Back in New York, Arthur dropped Hazel and Charlie off in front of the Chelsea and zoomed away with Maxine, off to a work party for his company up in the northern suburbs. While Hazel still had her doubts about Arthur, he did seem to be on his best behavior, and it wasn't worth falling out with her friend and lead actress by making a fuss and insisting Maxine come back to the hotel with her, especially when she knew she wouldn't listen. Besides, she wanted to continue her conversation with Charlie. "You didn't answer my question," said Hazel as the sedan pulled away from the curb, "about your father." "I know exactly who my dad is. I don't have any delusions about that. The work I'm doing now is only to help me get into the FBI." "So you can arrest actors instead of just intimidating them?" "It's more complicated than that." "I doubt that." He looked up at the building. "Let me come upstairs. You can give me that play, and I'll explain." "I'd be thrilled to be enlightened." Up in her apartment, she poured them both some scotch and opened the windows to let in the post-storm breeze. Charlie sat back on the sofa, drink in hand. "I'll be perfectly honest with you. I highly doubt the entertainment industry is rife with communists who are trying to overthrow democracy. That's all a ridiculous sideshow." "Why on earth do you work for American business consultants if that's what you think? You're a part of the machine that's tearing us all apart." She thought of Floyd and Brandy, of the way baseless claims could be used to target innocent people. "Because it's a professional stepping stone. You need to have 3 years of job experience after college before you can apply to be a Fed. And when I was offered a position as an investigator with Hartnett, it seemed like a smart place to bide my time. I'm proving I have the skills the FBI looks for." He let out a sigh. "Look, I do think my father is partly correct about the threat we're under. He has connections in the Bureau, and they've told us without a doubt that secrets are being relayed to the Soviets, that a network of spies is in place and has been in place for years. I want to be a part of that fight. I couldn't go to war because of my epilepsy, but if the FBI will let me in, that's how I'll serve my country." He continued on, gathering steam. "If I can prove to the FBI that we can catch the actual spies without a witch hunt, it'll all be worth it. Right now, yes, my father is persecuting innocents and has gone too far. I'm working to stop him from the inside, which, as his son, I know is the best way to change his mind. And if I can't change his mind, at least I can try to protect the artists he goes after, since I admire them immensely." He stared at her. Hazel felt a blush spread over her cheeks. "Is that why you volunteered to watch over the show?" "I felt I owed you after your help on the roof. To be honest, I like being in the theater every day, watching as you whip them into shape." "Well, your instincts are good. I know you don't say a lot of things because I've told you to keep it to yourself, but the ones I've let you offer up are pretty smart." "Like my idea to play Charlie Parker during scene changes?" "Yes, that one was a good one." She shifted so she was facing him, one leg bent across the couch and the other on the floor. Although she hated to admit it, Charlie was exactly the type of person who should be involved in politics or a government agency. Better him than the rigid right-wing McCarthy any day. At least he talked sense. "You can see that we're harmless, right? Admit that. At the very least, admit that." His jaw tightened. "You and your production? Yes, I can admit that. But there's so much else going on out there. Things that you don't know about, that you shouldn't know about. Like what? I can't say. Will we hear about it in the news one of these days, or is this the kind of thing that's going to stay underground, all conspiracy theory and conjecture? Soon. You'll hear something soon. She leaned in. Ooh, so scary. He touched her chin with his index finger, lightly, like he was casting a spell. Don't make fun. The feather-like stroke rippled through her. He pulled back, placing both hands in his lap. Unnerved, she rearranged her features into a polite smile as the sound of firecrackers reverberated over the city. When I first came to the hotel, I was so worried about what my mother thought, she finally said. We'd had a big fight, and I moved out for what I thought was a few days, but turned out to be permanent. I don't regret it one bit. It was only the second time I went against her wishes, the first being the USO tour, and I'm glad I did. Maybe by working on the show, you're declaring your own independence. I'm going to step out from under my father's shadow, one way or another. Charlie's voice was soft but firm. What the hell? Maybe if I get rejected by the FBI, I'll invest in your next production. Now you want to become a producer? She was going to tease him, but the look on his face was so sweet, so hopeful, that she pulled herself up short. I think that would be grand. You do? He glanced out the window, at his drink, anywhere but at her. She finally took his chin in her hand and made him focus. Yes. They stared again, but this time neither broke away. He leaned in and kissed her, pulled back and whispered, Is this okay? She moved into him. Yes. For once, she wanted to be the bad girl, like Maxine, to let herself go and stop overthinking everything, like the fact that Charlie was the worst possible choice as a lover for many reasons, to just stop thinking. They stayed on the couch for what seemed like hours, Charlie taking his time exploring her body and very slowly peeling off her dress, then her undergarments, until she was bare. The small part of her that was aghast at the exposure was quickly overwhelmed by her other senses. She became consumed by his inhale of breath, the touch of his fingers on her breast, the sting of scotch on their tongues. All thoughts of the play evaporated from her mind, just like the rainwater steaming off the black pavement of 23rd Street.
Chapter 15. Maxine. July 6th, 1950. We're in tech now, which means long, painful days for us actors. We stand on stage, say a few lines, then Hazel stops us, while the lighting designer fiddles about, and the set designer does the same. A few more lines, more fiddling. Of course, it's not fiddling. Canby had hired master lighting and set designers who would transform the naked stage into a believably decrepit hotel in a war-torn country. But for the actors, it's something to endure. We're dying to run through the show with lights, sets, and costumes, but Tech Week ground all that to a necessary halt. Floyd was missed, especially when we showed up for the costume parade at a cavernous warehouse in the West 30s, where members of the cast dress in full wardrobe for inspection by the creative team. Floyd's assistant had taken charge, but her boss's absence was palpable. I worried about Floyd, about where he was hiding out, what was going on behind the scenes that none of us were privy to. He'd been such a sweetheart in Naples, and I hated the thought that he was being bullied again, like he'd been bullied there. During the war, Hazel and I had been able to offer him a modicum of protection, but this time he'd pulled away, out of our orbit of safety. I wanted to weep at the thought of Floyd lost and alone, fearing a knock on the door, with absolutely no one to turn to. I wanted to break things and inflict pain, but our enemies were unseen, amorphous, evil. As I walked into the space, the actors, still wearing street clothes, were huddled in one corner, looking at something that Brandy held in her hand, and every eye turned to me as I entered. Brandy, always the bearer of bad news, thrust an issue of counterattack right in my face. "You really should take a look." Brandy spoke louder than she needed to. "Already seen it. This ain't new, dearie," I said. "Same folks who published the Red Channels rag, I hear. But you've been named." I glanced down. It was another list of people deemed as threats to America. While many of the others had at least 5 lines of offenses, mine only had 1, that lousy rally that I went to with Hazel's brother eons ago. Inside, I admit I was quaking, just a little. This was bad. I handed it back to her. "I've been called a lot of names in my time, and Commie won't be the last, I'm sure." Hazel clapped her hands and called for attention. From the rough edge in her voice, she'd already heard the news. "We're late. Everyone get dressed and let's get this show on the road." Normally, a dress parade is an exciting event. The costumes make the show feel real. While we'd had a number of fittings over the course of the rehearsal period, this is when you see the big picture, the color palette, what visual delights the audience is in for. It also makes you look at your fellow actors in a new way, more as the character than as the person you got to know outside of rehearsal. Costumes are a blast, usually. This time, it was as if all the air had been sucked out of the room. We lined up in front of Canby, Hazel, and the assistant costume designer. Hazel and Canby walked up and back, examining buttons and silhouettes, whispering with each other while we all held still. No joking, no banter, all business. Brandy stood tall, a smug smile on her face, in her tangerine dress. She'd gotten what she'd wanted after all. We were finally dismissed, and I lingered around after changing back into my street clothes, hoping to talk to Hazel privately. Charlie Butterfield had arrived, unfortunately. When I came out from the dressing room, Hazel, Canby, and he were talking in the middle of the room. I barged right up. "How bad is it?" Canby rubbed his face. "It's not good. Not good at all." Hazel crossed her arms. "Now we have 2 of us listed. There's nothing I can do about that. And trust me, I tried to get myself cleared. These charges are baseless." Charlie shook his head.
"I'll talk to Hartnett. Try to find out what happened."
We already knew what happened. The scene on the boardwalk with Charlie's father was the reason for the escalation. "What about me?" I couldn't help myself. "I was dragged to some silly rally years ago, and that gets shoved in there? We were there for all of 5 minutes. When I found out what it was, I insisted we leave." I wished I could take back the words as soon as I said them. Hazel glanced over at me. "Can we talk alone for a second?" She held up a finger to Canby and Charlie. I knew what was coming. "Was that the rally I saw you at? With my brother?" Hazel kept her voice down as we walked into one of the dressing rooms. I didn't want to answer. I didn't. But she could tell from the look on my face that I had been with Ben. "This is terrible," she said. "I hate that he was the one who got you listed." "There's nothing we can do about it now, except stay the course and see if this all dies down." My words rang a little hollower every time I said them. I felt terrible for Hazel. This should be her shining hour. Instead, the show's reputation was being sullied a little more each day. We took a cab home together, both of us eager to put this day behind us. But as we waited for the elevator, a man who'd been sitting on the lobby's couch rose and called Hazel's name. "Yes?
Are you Miss Hazel Ripley?"
"That's me." He handed her an envelope with her name typed on it in capital letters.
I'm here to serve a subpoena from the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Chapter 16. Hazel. July 1950. After Hazel checked into the Washington, D.C. hotel recommended by her lawyer, she put on a silk bathrobe and hung up her dress for the following day. One didn't want to show up wrinkled in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee. She'd chosen a navy tailored suit with a relaxed silhouette that hit right below the knee, about as generic and unfeminine as one could get. Her aim was to meet the committee, comprised all of men, of course, on their own level. Be straightforward, not get pushed around. Inside, though, she was terrified. If she angered the members of the committee, her chances of getting the show mounted on Broadway would drop to zero. But if she placated them, she could never live with herself. Everything had moved at lightning speed since the subpoena had been placed in her hand. She'd gotten the referral for her lawyer, Andrew Z. Stone, Esquire, from Mr. Canby the next morning. "You'll be in good hands with him. He's an honest man and is agreeable to representing blacklisted artists," Mr. Canby told her. When she'd met Mr. Stone in his midtown office a few hours later, he'd made some calls in an attempt to get her a private meeting with the committee, but had been refused. "In that case, the sooner you appear, the better," he'd advised. "They're thirsty for blood, and the longer you put them off, the angrier they'll become." The committee members were feeding on the outrage generated by every appearance, getting nastier and less careful about legal propriety. So she'd agreed to appear the next Monday, the company's last day off before previews began, in front of a dozen or so politicians, with the press documenting her every word. Which was the following morning at 11 a.m. A knock at the door broke the silence of the room.
"Who is it?"
"Me." She swept open the door and Charlie slipped inside. "What on earth are you doing here? We said I'd do this on my own." He didn't answer, but held her close. They'd decided after their first night together that the relationship had to be kept under wraps, at least for now, even from close friends like Maxine. No good could come from news of their alliance getting out, not with all the negative attention on Hazel, but they both hated the thought of being apart. The feel of Charlie's arms around Hazel made her wilt inside, just when she needed her strength. To let go and let someone else hold her up was too much, and she began to sob. He led her to the sofa and pulled her down beside him, offering up a handkerchief, which she gratefully took. "How did you get up here? Did anyone see you?" He shook his head. "I came in through the kitchen. No one said a word." "I had to see you." "You're crazy." "That's true." After they kissed, she settled her head on his shoulder. "All I want to do is write plays and put them up. That's it. I have no other agenda. But I'm trapped in this nightmare, and if I don't do well tomorrow, if I don't put on the performance of my life, I may never work again. I'll lose everything." "What does your attorney say?" She sat up straight, all business. "I have three options. I take the fifth, refuse to answer their questions, and get held in contempt, possibly sent to jail. Or I can be a cooperative witness and give up the names of people who've been members of the Communist Party at one time or another. If I do that, there's a good chance I can continue on with my career, but I'll have placed others in the same precarious position I am in today." She rubbed her face with her hands. "And the third option?" "I tell them that I'll answer any questions about myself, but none about other people. But here's the rub. If I do that, I'll have waived my rights under the Fifth Amendment and could be legally forced to name names. That's all they're after, more names. I'm supposed to prostrate myself before them, show that their paranoia is valid by offering up more sacrificial lambs, friends who've done nothing wrong. It's political purgatory." "There now." Charlie placed both hands on her legs as if trying to stop her from floating into air, which is exactly what she felt like, a balloon that could be popped at any moment before falling to the ground in jagged pieces. "Stone considers the third option morally correct, but the committee might still hold me in contempt." "What's his advice, then?" His words were edged with exasperation. "Isn't that why you hired him?" "Look, it's not his fault. He's trying to help." Of course, you're right. I just want to kill someone, specifically my father, for his part in this sideshow. Trust me, I know that feeling. But Stone's been helpful. He told me never to answer any question with a flat-out no. I'm supposed to soften it with, not that I can recall, or, it was so long ago, I'm afraid I don't remember. If I try to defend the people they're asking me about, the committee might very well produce testimony by others that contradicts what I say, catching me in a lie. Then I'll be charged with perjury. It's a twisted, sick game. I don't know what others who've appeared before me have said to the committee, which makes me as paranoid as they are, and more likely to do whatever it takes to get out of the hot seat. You won't do that. You're stronger than that. Charlie's support was a much-needed comfort. I wrote up a statement with Mr. Stone's help, saying that I would not object to answering any questions about myself, but wouldn't impugn others. It was sent to them by messenger a few days ago. That seems reasonable. She reached over to the coffee table and picked up an envelope. It was delivered back to me today, unopened. So you'll have to do your talking yourself, not rely on the page. You can do that. I'm a writer, not a politician or a lawyer. They hold all the cards. Besides, they don't care what I say. They just want to get me in a bind and squeeze me hard so that they can prove to the American public that democracy is a minute away from collapse. By standing up for yourself, you'll prove that it's not. And go to jail. Lose everything. You won't, I promise. I love you, Hazel. Ever since they'd made love up in her room at the Chelsea, Hazel had found herself desperate to be touching Charlie whenever he was near, either laying a hand on his arm as they passed in the aisle of the Biltmore, or shoulder to shoulder as they whispered back and forth in the house seats. Only with that touch did she feel that all was right in the world, that the problems were surmountable. It was as if her body had known she was in love with him before her mind had. But the connection wasn't only about physical passion, she knew now. She valued his ideas and opinions, shared his passion for the theater, and wanted more than anything to spend every moment they could together, laughing and talking before curling up in bed when the day was through. The realization made her forget, for a moment, the nightmare she was trapped inside. She pulled him close and stared into his eyes, already feeling the heat of their connection. I love you, too. Hazel propped herself up with several pillows and watched as Charlie dressed in the morning light. His legs were solid but not thick. Perfect, really, and she couldn't get enough of the way the small of his back curved up, the indentation of the spine that ran like a channel between his shoulders. He kissed her goodbye and wished her good luck, promising that he'd see her back in New York, and after he'd gone, she ordered some coffee from room service and glanced again through the 20-something questions her lawyer had given her to study. As the letters floated around on the page, she remembered she'd had the typical understudy's nightmare last night, that she had to go on but hadn't had time to memorize the part, exactly what had happened that first day in Naples. Here she was, back to learning lines instead of writing them, and her brain refused to cooperate. It might as well have been in Mandarin. In a cold sweat, she pulled off the hotel robe and threw it on the floor. She'd have called Maxine for comfort if the Chelsea Hotel's phone lines weren't tapped. Instead, Hazel was completely alone, treading water in a whirlpool of nerves. She met Mr. Stone for breakfast at a corner table of the hotel restaurant, where he whispered further instructions. You can take exactly one break, only if things get too difficult. And no jokes. Jokes? Why would I joke? You'd be surprised what people do under that kind of pressure. A colleague of mine had a client who said he wasn't going to break and ended up throwing all his friends' names out to the committee, including his college roommate and best friend. That won't be me, I assure you. Do I get to meet the loudmouth Joseph McCarthy? Mr. Stone blanched. I said no jokes. You've got to be serious about this. No, you won't. He's focused on investigating the State Department for communist infiltration. For now. But I warn you, the HUAC is just as serious. Believe me, I know. Hazel looked out at the people on the street, going about their day, worried about a dentist appointment or what to buy for dinner that evening. How wonderful it would be to go back to that state of mundane, everyday bliss. Once this was over, if it was ever over, she'd appreciate the more modest joys of life. But wasn't that what everyone said when their lives took a terrible turn? The committee room in the old House office building seemed like something right out of an Oscar Wilde play, with its dark wood, refined striped wallpaper, and globed sconces. Clerks passed official-looking papers back and forth. Stenographers sat at the ready in front of their machines. Members of the public took their seats and murmured among themselves, while photographers squeezed in wherever they could get the best angle. Hazel and Mr. Stone took their seats, and again she scanned the list of questions. Again they floated around in her vision like fireflies. "Here they come." Mr. Stone leaned close. "Take your time. Speak slowly and clearly. Don't let them rattle you." The members of the committee, all scowling, middle-aged men, filed in and took their places on a raised platform. The chairman, Congressman John S. Wood, banged his gavel.
"The House Un-American Activities Committee will come to order. This morning, the committee resumes its series of hearings on the vital issue of communist propaganda and influence in the entertainment industry."
The first questions were easy. Hazel supplied her name, where she was born, her current place of residence, her education, her occupation, the title of her play.
"Miss Ripley, are you a member of the Communist Party?"
"No."
"Were you ever asked to be a member of the Communist Party?"
"No."
The chairman shook his head after her reply, as if he knew something she didn't. He looked at his notes.
"Did you sign a petition for the Scientific and Cultural Conference for World Peace?"
She took a deep breath, remembering to answer with care. "At a rehearsal for a play, I don't remember which one, a group of young people approached me outside the theater and asked if I'd sign a petition so they could be representatives at a peace conference. I thought having a conference for peace was a great idea, so I did so."
"Did you question as to whether this so-called conference was a communist front?"
"Why would I?"
Hazel sensed Mr. Stone twitch beside her, worried that she was getting riled.
"Answer the question."
"No, I did not."
"What about the anti-fascist rally you attended in 1938?
"What about it?"
She knew she shouldn't talk back, but couldn't help herself.
"Did you know that it was organized by the Communist Party?"
"I knew that I was against fascism, as we all were in those days, and are currently, unless I'm mistaken about the purpose and outcome of World War II.
The chairman looked down at the stenographers.
"Please note that the witness refuses to answer the question."
He glared at Hazel.
"You also sent birthday greetings to the Moscow Art Theater on its 50th anniversary, did you not?"
"The Moscow Art Theater is a distinguished institution in the theater world, like the old Vic in London. I got a phone call asking if I'd like to be added to the list of people offering congratulations, and I said sure. The telegram had nothing to do with politics or the Soviet Union or communists."
"Who was the person who called you?"
"I have no memory of the caller's name."
"You are currently a member of the Actors' Equity Association, is that correct?"
"Yes. If one wants to work on Broadway, one must be a member of the union."
"I see."
His raised eyebrow suggested otherwise.
"You appear to be associated with a number of organizations and causes that we know to be communist organizations or fronts."
He fingered the gavel. Another committee member, Congressman Richard M. Nixon, took over the line of questioning. "I'm going to ask you a question, and I'd like you to take a moment before answering." She knew what was coming, the ultimate test of a witness's cooperation, naming names. The failure to do so would signify that she was protecting potential infiltrators and was not a true American, a serious offense.
"Considering your extensive contact with people and organizations that spread communist propaganda," said Congressman Nixon, "do you know anyone who has been a member of the Communist Party? Fellow travelers, if you will."
"I'm sure you already have a long list of names of people who you consider to be fellow travelers. I am not interested in confirming, denying, or adding to it."
The members of the public gasped, giving the chairman reason to slam down his gavel a few times for good measure.
"What about your brother?"
continued Congressman Nixon, a Mr. Benjamin Ripley. He was a member of the Communist Party. Am I correct or not? Once again, her beloved brother's name was being dragged through the mud. What these men were doing was no different than if they'd exhumed his bones and danced on them. Enough was enough. Hazel let rip. My brother was killed in the war. He's not here to defend his name, and I am shocked you'd try to use him to get me to testify against others. You're not interested in discovering subversives or uncovering some dastardly plot against America. You only want to push people like me around to prove how powerful you are, to publicly stigmatize and degrade. The chairman lectured Hazel at great length after her outburst, while Mr. Stone asked for a break, which was denied. But as the furor died down, a lone voice, a baritone Hazel didn't recognize, rang out from the back of the room. Thank God someone is talking straight. Finally. Once again, the room went wild. Hazel turned around but couldn't tell who'd said it. More yelling, more banging of gavels, and in that time, Hazel was able to regroup, pull herself together. That one voice, breaking out through the bitterness and allegations, made all the difference. She knew she wasn't alone in this madhouse, and that she was strong enough to manage what was next. She gave a silent prayer of thanks to her anonymous supporter. Once again, after order was restored, the chairman resumed his questioning. Do you know a Mr. Floyd Jenkins? I do. We met in Naples, and he designed the costumes for my play. Is he, or has he ever been, a member of the Communist Party? She remembered his rallying declaration at Sardi's, in front of practically the entire cast and crew. If Hazel's a communist, then I'm one, too. We must all stand together. Unfortunately, there seemed to be no tolerance for sarcasm in these dark days. No doubt the committee already had Brandy's witness testimony, and if Hazel answered the truth, that Floyd wasn't, they could accuse her of perjury. I am willing to respond to any questions that pertain to me or my activities. I understand from counsel that, under the Fifth Amendment, I can refuse questions about myself on the ground of self-incrimination. I don't need to take the Fifth, because, as I've shown, I'm willing to discuss my actions and intent. But I will not name other people or answer questions about their actions or intent. You are not in a position to set the terms here, Miss Ripley. I will ask you again. Floyd Jenkins, a communist or not? I refuse to answer on the ground that it might incriminate me. I will take the Fifth because you refuse to agree to a reasonable request. She turned to Mr. Stone, forgetting that the microphone would pick up her every word. As a theatrical production, this is first rate, right up there with Nick Bottom and the Mechanicals. Nick Bottom? The chairman pounced. This Nick Bottom you speak of, is he a communist? Hazel burst out laughing, as did several of the spectators. After a sharp look from Mr. Stone, she spoke clearly and succinctly into the microphone for all to hear. He's a character from Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, a fictional character. The room broke out in pandemonium again. Strike that from the record. This is a waste of time. Strike it off! The chairman's neck, and then cheeks, turned crimson. He grappled with the papers in front of him and rose to his feet. That's enough. We have no further questions. The hearing was over. Mr. Stone grabbed her by the arm. We have to get out of here fast. Follow me and don't answer any questions. Not one. Understand? They made it out through the scrum and leaped into a car that had been waiting by the curb. I may be wrong, but I think you did it. Mr. Stone looked like he was about to break into song. Did what? You laid bare their political agenda and embarrassed them to boot. The way Chairman Wood got flustered at the end there bodes well. He won't want this getting out. He switched back to sober, wary attorney. I have to say, you were lucky. You pushed back, and I think that caught them by surprise, you being a woman and all. Let's hope you're right. Who was that man, the one that spoke out? He's a reporter from the Chicago Tribune. I don't know whether that's good or bad for us. We'll find out soon enough. Hazel leaned back, letting the relief wash over her and praying that Mr. Stone's initial assessment was correct, that, at the very least, she had a chance of keeping Wartime Sonata on track.
Chapter 17. Hazel. July 1950. Hazel's nerves kicked into high gear as she arrived at the theater for the first preview. She'd had some oatmeal for breakfast, which threatened to come up, and retreated to the mezzanine level to take some deep breaths. At least the critics weren't coming until next week. Charlie joined her, sneaking in a quick kiss. "How are you holding up?" They hadn't had any time alone since she'd returned, although she'd given him, Mr. Canby, and Maxine a quick rundown after rehearsal yesterday. She wished she and Charlie could escape somewhere private and curl around each other instead of having to stand at a distance and appear to be acquaintances in case any of the ushers came by. "I'm doing fine, I suppose. Tell me what really went on in Washington. Everyone's talking about the article in the Tribune." She took a deep breath. "My lawyer says I successfully embarrassed the committee in public, and so far they've seemed eager to sweep me under the rug, not charge me with contempt. So that's good news. I would have thought it would be easier to sweep it under the rug if it hadn't been reported on. No, that journalist is a hero, in my opinion. He stood up and called them out on their monstrous behavior, then had the courage to write about it, depicting me as a linchpin in the battle for America's soul, which, I suppose, made me untouchable in a way. They can't arrest me without looking like they're trying to hide something. Then again, if you'd been arrested, it might have highlighted how unreasonable everything is and might have threatened the power of the blacklisters. You looking to put me in jail?" She was only half-teasing. He shook his head. "God, no, not at all. Just following the logic." "That's the trouble. There seems to be no logic, not with that crew. In any event, I'm still on the blacklist when it comes to television, film, and radio, so they've won in that sense. That won't matter. Once the play's up and running, you'll be the queen of Broadway. Your confidence is premature. Don't jinx us, kiddo." In fact, while Hazel's appearance before the committee had made a splash for a day, the vitriol ran deep against anyone who refused to heed the call for blood, for informing on friends. Hazel didn't tell Charlie that she'd already started receiving hate mail, her cubby behind the counter in the lobby stuffed with bland-looking white envelopes filled with vile accusations, as well as anonymous threatening telephone calls, always from men. Mr. Bard had told the switchboard operator to take messages and stop putting them through. "What if no one comes to the show because of my testimony?" Charlie guided her back downstairs. "Why don't you run through the final changes, and then you can worry about all the stuff that's out of your control. Sound good?" "As usual, you're right." Down in the house, Hazel called for the actors to assemble on stage. While she waited for the last of them to appear from the wings, she and Charlie stood for a moment, smiling at each other and not saying a word, until Mr. Canby sidled between them. "Hey, Charlie, can you check with the box office? Curious how many seats we've sold so far. I'll be back in 5. Charlie headed up the aisle. Mr. Canby waited until he was out of earshot. "Whatever you're doing with the kid, keep it up." She tried to wipe the smile off her face fast. Was it that obvious? "What do you mean?" "Ah, come on. If it takes leading the kid on in order to get what we want, I'm all for it. I haven't seen a puppy face like that since, well, since never. He's an open book, and he obviously adores you." "He's a good person." She wanted to say that it was real, not an act, and that she wasn't leading him on in any way, but she knew better. Charlie's love was like a coat of armor she carried around with her everywhere, one that buffered her from the world's razor-sharp spears. She'd noticed, since falling in love, that she attracted more attention from men, from not-so-covert glances to unexpected flirtations. Her confidence had increased, knowing he was in her life, that she was loved, which, in turn, seemed to make her more appealing to the opposite sex. No doubt this was how Maxine, as a starlet, was treated every day, like a prize to be won. The power was heady. When the stage manager called places at exactly 8 o'clock that evening, Hazel hid down in the basement. She'd already stopped by all the dressing rooms and breezily wished everyone well, told them all to break a leg, but her nerves were shot. It was easier to be an actor any day than a writer. You had a job to do. You got on stage and you did it. As the playwright, she had to suffer through hearing the audience's reaction, or non-reaction, knowing she could no longer stop the show mid-performance and make adjustments. The sound of the curtain lifting drove her out of her hiding place and up to the balcony, far above the stage, where Charlie was waiting. Only half of the seats in that section were filled. All this worrying, and most likely the show would sink without any fanfare at all. Right after the second act began, she motioned to Charlie, and they crept downstairs, standing at the very back of the orchestra level. At least most of the seats here were filled. Mr. Canby had probably handed out free tickets in Times Square. The actors were all doing their jobs beautifully. Maxine had matured into the role and commanded the stage just as she'd done on the USO tour, but had layered in a hint of fragility that worked perfectly for Lena. Her leading man drew laughs with his silly entrances and exits, allowing the audience to let off some steam as the tension in the play rose page after page. When he was killed and Maxine mourned the loss of him before being sent to her own execution, Charlie nudged Hazel and pointed out to the audience. Even though she could see only backs, several people were shaking with sobs. Handkerchiefs were out, noses blown, as the emotional vibrations echoed around the theater. In the last scene, the audience stayed rapt. The falling of the curtain at the very end of the play was met with silence. Hazel waited, holding her breath. Maybe she'd read it all wrong. Maybe they hated it for making them feel so awful, for reminding them of the trauma of World War II, which was over and done with. Maybe she'd failed horribly. But then one man near the front clapped twice. Others joined in, and within 10 seconds, the entire theater echoed with shouts and clapping as the crowd rose to its feet en masse. Charlie grabbed Hazel and kissed her. "You did it! You absolutely did it!" Backstage, Mr. Canby surprised them with bottles of champagne. "You all worked hard," he said, as the stage manager popped a cork. "I'm happy to be able to announce that a new American playwright has arrived, one who isn't afraid to speak out, to speak up. Our very own champion of the arts, Hazel Ripley." Hazel left the Sunday matinee in good spirits, looking forward to an easy stroll down 8th Avenue. She liked walking home from the theater instead of hopping in a cab, as it gave her time to think about the play, what small directorial tweaks needed to be made, the best way to convey them to the actors or the crew. The show was coming together nicely, each performance building on the one that came before. There had been a couple of technical glitches, but that was to be expected, and they'd been addressed right off. She had to give it to Mr. Canby. He had a great team in place. The guard at the stage door handed her a note as she left. It was from Charlie, asking her to meet him at the entrance to the Staten Island Ferry. She caught a subway downtown, wondering what this was all about. Charlie paid 2 nickels for the fare, and they boarded, surrounded by a mass of commuters. The playfulness that they'd fallen into was nowhere to be found. He was all business. "What's going on, Charlie? Why bring me all the way out here?" "I wanted to find somewhere we could talk, but not call too much attention to ourselves." They moved to the back of the boat, where the skyline of Manhattan slowly receded as the ferry chugged into the harbor. Hazel leaned over the railing and let the wind whip her hair around her face as the ferry picked up speed, charging through the choppy waters. Part of her wished she could escape the city entirely, leave it all behind her, find a job selling clothes in a department store in New Jersey, say, and ignore the threats leveled her way. Writing the play had been a solitary endeavor, and she'd enjoyed every moment. But by mounting a play on Broadway, she'd exposed herself. In normal times, her biggest worry right about now would be the critics coming next week. Instead, she was caught up in a political storm. She rearranged her scarf over her hair and tied it under her neck, partly to keep it from flying into her mouth and partly to obscure her face. The passengers around them weren't paying them any mind, but still. Was the businessman holding on to his hat, listening in on their conversation? Were the couple, with their arms around each other, federal agents? She was becoming paranoid. She had to keep a clear head. "What is it, then?" He turned away from her and rested both forearms on the railing. She did the same, their elbows touching. He took a deep breath. "They're about to make a big arrest. My guess is, once that happens, the focus will turn to where it should be, on the actual spies." "They are? Who's they?" "The FBI." He lowered his voice so she could barely hear him above the churning of the ship's engine. "How do you know this?"
a high-up official at the FBI who was in the war with my father. He keeps him informed of what's going on. The fact that Charlie had taken her into his confidence, entrusted her with what could be explosive information, was thrilling. At the same time, Hazel worried about being told secrets that could possibly land her in more trouble just for knowing them. The risk was worth it, she decided. Tell me what you heard. A few months ago, a scientist and an army sergeant were arrested on espionage charges. Both men were passing along atomic secrets bound for the Soviets, but now the feds have cornered the person who brought them together in the first place. It's a New Yorker, a member of the Communist Party USA. He's an electrical engineer named Julius Rosenberg, married with a couple of kids. They're closing in on him, and the arrest will be announced any day now. Hazel wasn't convinced. How do we know the FBI isn't railroading an innocent man into confessing? Like Floyd, for instance. How do we know this electrical engineer hasn't been set up to take a fall, to show the American public that they have reason for concern? I wouldn't put it past the HUAC or the FBI to manufacture an enemy to justify their overreach of civil liberties. They're passing along atomic secrets, Hazel. You've got to see how serious this is. He turned his head and gave her a hard look. This is no longer theatrical. It's not a game. Trust me, it's just as dead serious when it's theatrical. What's going on Broadway is not a game in any way. Of course it isn't. I didn't mean it that way. Sorry, my love. She considered what he'd told her. If a real spy was exposed, maybe that would ease up the pressure on the artists, put focus where it should be, just as Charlie had said all along. Maybe this would be a good turn of events and put a stop to the false incriminations. And if that happened, she and Charlie could take their relationship public, since they'd no longer be on opposite sides. All this speculation left her dizzy, confused. Charlie laughed, almost to himself. All because of Jell-O. What? She was sure she misheard him. Apparently that's how the two spies identified each other before the handoff. Each was given a ripped half of a Jell-O box top. The two halves fitted together. What flavor? He laughed again, louder this time. Leave it to you to ask the least pertinent question. I'll check and get back to you. It's all too strange to be true, she quickly added. I guess I believe it. I believe you, of course. But if the spy ring's techniques were that primitive, how effective could they have been at stealing atomic secrets? During World War II, Russia was barely able to keep up demand for basic weaponry. These days, they're practically going toe-to-toe with us. There's a reason for this steep increase in technology, and it's not because they finally figured out the math. They've been fed it, and they'll use it against us given the first opportunity. I hope you're wrong. I'm not. They stood for a while, not saying a word, watching the seagulls dive and dip around them.
Chapter 18. Maxine. July 18th, 1950. I was only called in for a quick morning rehearsal today and looked forward to an afternoon of leisure. But as I was leaving the theater, Arthur pulled up in his car and motioned for me to get in. I did as directed, and he drove away fast, waiting until we were heading up 8th Avenue before speaking. They got Julius. I stayed quiet, digesting the information. I'd heard Arthur mention the name a few times before, but had never met him. How did you hear? Arthur picked up a newspaper on the seat between us and hurled it at me. Don't you read the newspapers? The front page headline proclaimed, Fourth American Held as Atom Spy. I glanced down the column, jumping to page 8 for the rest. Near the top was a photo of a disheveled-looking man flanked by two FBI agents. One lock of hair fell onto his forehead. His heavy-lidded eyes made him look like he'd just woken up. I started to say something, but Arthur broke in. Don't say another word. I don't want you to open your mouth. They're close, and you're next. We drove out of town, up along the Hudson on Route 9 for about an hour.
At Croton-on-Hudson, we peeled off and up a winding road to a hilltop. The town had become an enclave for artists and left-leaning socialists back in the 1920s, to the extent that it was referred to as Red Hill. Arthur followed a narrow dirt driveway a few hundred feet until it opened out onto a compound of small houses. None of them interesting, with shutters or porches or gardens, just boxes, really, with doors and windows. He parked around the back of one of the houses, and we entered through a back door. "We don't want to be seen, even here." He pointed to a small room off to the side. "Wait inside and don't come out until I tell you to." I sat on a small bed with a worn orange coverlet, the only furniture in the room. Outside, the sun danced on the trees. It was a gorgeous summer day, but what little breeze there was didn't make it through the screened-in window. A ladybug skated across the sill. That's when I started thinking about the truth, about telling the truth, as if it might set me free. So far, I've kept my promise not to put pen to paper about this mess. I've kept this secret for years, on orders. But I can't keep the secret any longer. Arthur is my controller, among other things. I'm a spy. I've kept it out of my diary, but I can't anymore. The act of writing calms me, takes away the dread and panic for a little while. It's the only way I can make sense of it all. I've found a hiding place for these pages, under a loose board on the mantel of my fireplace in the Chelsea Hotel. Not even the hotel maids will discover it there. For the first time, I'm really scared. Of the party, of Arthur, of what I've done. Growing up, I saw my German grandmother horribly abused by Americans. I watched as capitalism destroyed my father and turned him mean. It's true, I found haven in the acting company, but what I didn't mention is the founders were supporters of the Communist Party. They introduced me to the American League Against War and Fascism, a communist front organization. The members listened to me when I spoke. They cared about what I thought. Even though I was a girl, they gave me responsibilities. My gender wasn't a hindrance for the first time ever, and I found respect there. When I wasn't at school or working on plays, I served as financial secretary and studied Marxism-Leninism. Arthur encouraged me, pushed me. This gave me purpose, and I blossomed. They figured I'd be useful in New York City, where membership in the Communist Party was surging during the mid-30s, especially among theater folk and others still reeling from the Depression. I continued to be shocked by the racism and poverty in America. The economic freefall had cut a raw wound in society's skin and exposed the maggots and filth deep inside. I truly believed that communism would eradicate these evils. At the Chelsea Hotel, I felt finally at home. It was an artistic community, full of creative people who disagreed and fought and then met for drinks, and Lavinia took me under her wing and made me feel like I belonged. At the Chelsea, it didn't matter how much money you had in your bank account, what schools you attended, or where you were born. Neighbors treated each other as equals, and talent and wit carried the day, the way the world should be. Soon after arriving in New York, I got the ultimate praise. I was taken underground. The Communist Party USA had a secret department, a clandestine arm that coordinated with Soviet intelligence agents. We stayed low, out of sight, and were given missions via our controllers. A couple of times, I was asked to go on a date with a journalist or rabble-rouser who seemed sympathetic to our cause, to see if they could be convinced to spy against America. Hazel's brother, A card-carrying member of the party was a ripe target. We went on a few dates, but I got the distinct impression he didn't hold enough of a grudge to flip. And after he brought me to that demonstration, the last place I wanted to be seen, I broke up with him fast. I couldn't risk being exposed. I believed in this cause. I believed that the world would be a better place if we were all equals. Not American equality, which really meant the ones with the most money had the most pull, but truly equal. Through it all, Arthur was my glue, what kept me together. I'd fallen in love with him right off and did whatever I could to please him. As a team, we were magnificent. Arthur rose higher in the ranks. I stayed by his side through it all. Reliable. Dependable. A couple of years into the war, I was instructed to audition for the USO touring company and relay what I could to Arthur. But soon after arriving in Europe, I got the message that it was too risky and to shut down all contact. I liked having that reprieve, I have to admit, of just being an actress, not an operative. If I'd still been working for the party, I might not have let myself get so close to Hazel. But I was vulnerable, and the war unsettled my preconceptions about America, as you couldn't help but root for the soldiers. But when Paul was killed, because the Americans screwed up and put him in danger, my resolve returned. I headed to California, hoping to marry Arthur and continue our work, only to discover he'd been married off to another agent, on orders of the party. They did that all the time, as married couples tended to attract less attention. But I'd thought it would be me. The party knew best, Arthur said, and we were still a couple, in every way but that. Determined to impress, I threw myself into my assignment to infiltrate the film industry, and boy did I. The faster my star rose, the more excited Arthur and the others became. With success would come access to powerful men across the country, Mr. Butterfield being a perfect example, where I could listen in on conversations and report back what I heard, all while playing the role of silly actress. The night we found out that Marilyn Monroe had gotten the part I was up for and was so close to landing was the same night Arthur cut off my hair as punishment for my failure. In Hollywood, you don't get a do-over. Once an up-and-comer has been passed over for a lead role, there's a pretty good chance of being sidelined forever. Arthur's brutality got his point across, and when I read about Hazel's play in Variety, I figured I could redeem myself by landing a starring role on Broadway, by being a big fish in a smaller pond, at least temporarily. They agreed it was a logical step, one that